Anyway, so the funny thing about this is, we did this first, which is by far the most complicated thing. Here we use 98% free probability. Here we use no free probability. That's a little bit quantum probability, and this is completely elementary. So somehow, I mean, it becomes sort of more and more trivial. I apologize. I can't help. So
let's go further. So I'm talking about Bell inequalities. This is the hardest part of the talk for me because I'm really not into this stuff. But I start reading this and it's really interesting. First of all, I really like the word Gedanken experiment all the time. So that's the point, right? You can do a quantum experiment, and then you get an outcome, and you can show that whatever kind of classical information you use to produce it, it doesn't work. That's the principle in a nutshell, but I'm not the first to explain that, to ask an expert, a real expert about this. But I will, you know, put it into mathematical terms in a second. And the point Bell inequalities comes from exactly this kind of inequalities, which just produce a certain matrix with certain plus and minuses, and then you apply that with the right configuration, and then you get different results. Usually, Bell inequalities are important because that's how you actually can show that you have entanglement, right? I mean, if you were not having entanglement, you couldn't see that. And that's somehow a subject that we're going to come back to. My colleague from U of I, Kriya, he's actually doing, I mean, you can go in a lab and see this. This is impressive. Anyway. So this is the situation. I mean, that really goes back to these old papers. So there's Alice and Bob, and they do experiments, a number of them. So that's important here for the rest of the talk. They're not only doing one experiment. They can choose a number of experiments, X and Y, and then they have an outcome. They have different outcomes, A and B. And then P, A, B, X, Y is just the probability that under the condition that you choose experiment X and Y, you get outcome A and B. So that's what we are talking about. And that's exactly already, I mean, in these very early papers, they do exactly this. So it's nice. I want to go the other way around. So if you consider these probabilities, and you should actually be more precise, it's a family of probabilities, they have some nice properties, which we should not ignore. I like to ignore them because for my norms, they're a little bit nasty. But if you sum over all A, and leave B, X, and Y free, then you get something in these experiments which doesn't depend on X anymore. So this is a condition on these probabilities. They're not completely arbitrary. This is the non-signally condition. It took us a lot of time to understand why this is less important, but that's interesting. It's just something one should not ignore if you really want to have some connection to the physical interpretation. And so we have this, I mean, let me just point this out. So this independent in X, and here you have the independent in Y. And if you sum it all up, it's 1. And the classical model now is really super, super nice. So these local probabilities, they're obtained in the following way. Omega is your, all possible nature, all possible choices of constructions you can make. Then we multiply these things here locally. And this is a product. That's very important. So the lambda is not a product measure. It's just one measure. And then PAX lambda and QBY of lambda, they are just really, you know, point-wise. These are probabilities. Sum over APX lambda is 1, and sum over QB lambda is 1. So it's an average. And somehow, if this were just plus or minus, just 0-1 probabilities, that would actually really correspond to making a classical experiment, and then you average over all possible choices of classical experiments. That, I think, is the right interpretation for this local probability, and the quantum version is really, really entirely an analog. I mean, that will not be a big thing for you now. So instead of... this I cannot take out. Now we produce quantum probabilities here, right, by having operators TXA, SBY. They correspond to the PA lambdas before. But now the averages are taken in a quantum sense. So we should assume that these are positive operators, which sum up to the identity in configuration for all x and y, right? So this is exactly the analog of a quantum probability compared to a classical or locum probability. And then if you want to iterate this, you can iterate this at infinity. But, you know, if you want to have three systems, then you just take three systems and the Hilbert space would be different. So this is the quantum version of the classical families of probabilities we want to consider. And then, of course, well, we want to show that there are more quantum probabilities than classical or local probabilities. And that is exactly what Pierides' paper by Balwick did. So, in classical, if you want to somehow simplify this experiment, what you do is you do an extra average procedure. That's a little bit too much. So you can imagine that you just, you know, you have all these probabilities given, but that sort of you can just average over them and imagine that there's a certain probabilities, this gives you an assignment of plus or minus one. And then you eliminate this variable A, so it makes it sort of easier, and these correlations are easy to do. And we see that somehow there's a symmetric option here. We do this on Alice's side and on Bob's side, so this will depend on, this probably should be a Y here, but anyway, this is always very symmetric. And then we get new coefficients out of our experiments where now we, not before, you know, before, let me write this before. So before we have, you know, A, B, X, Y, four coefficients. If we also average over A and B by, you know, for every A and B by using this plus minus one variables, then we put this inside and we get only dependence on X and Y, and these are then called correlation matrices, which you obtain in the classical and the quantum world. The classical one are just averages. And now if you look at these ux lambdas here, since p lambda ax is a probability and epsilon is only plus minus 1, the u lambda x, ux lambda individually for fixed lambda and x can only be between minus 1 and plus 1. That's the worst thing which can happen, right? So that's important translation for our next step. And again, you can do this with three parties. And so the whole point which we want to do is, which is sort of the easiest thing in the world. You have two quantities, right? I mean, in principle, I should do this picture. This is one convex set like this and another convex set like that, right? And how do we decide that these two sets are not equal? Well, if you look at them and you see that, that's very easy. But one way to decide that convex sets are not equal is you take a point in here and then you convex geometry, right? You're supporting hyperplane, and you somehow want to see that this distance is large, it's very much not the same. And this is the whole idea. And these lines correspond to equations, and these are the Bell inequalities. I mean, Bell inequalities are given by these lines, really, right? So this is testing with linear constraints, but I think that's not the only way, but so far in our theory, linear constraints are important. So if you go to the case of correlations, we just discussed that these operators ux lambda and vx lambda, they only allow values between plus and minus 1. And that is exactly what I'm saying. If you have such a matrix corresponding to such a line, then the only thing you can test on the right-hand side, actually this should be an equality, are plus minus 1 choices. Right? So we have a matrix and we check over all plus minus 1 choices. And so this here should be an equality. And this is the local expression. Right? So, and if you want to compare it with a quantum expression, I hope I do that. Yes, here it is. If you want to compare it with a quantum expression, you keep the same matrix, of course. And now here, you check with these new coefficients. And we are taking the supremum over all h of norm less than 1. Yeah? And here we have these self-adjoint operators. Right? So self-adjoint operators which are of norm less than 1. And norm less than 1 corresponds to the case that before we could only work between minus 1 and plus 1. If you average, you can actually take any value. So we want to compare somehow this norm here of the matrix with that norm here of the matrix. So maybe I will just write this down here. So we have the norm M equals epsilon is the supremum over all local correlations. Summation CXY MXY, and then the matrix M min norm is the supremum of all C quantum And why I choose epsilon and middle, I will explain that a little bit later, okay? But it's really very easy to translate that problem. Now, the correlation case is a little bit nicer. I mean, I should probably make a little bar here. So the correlation case is nicer because the convex sets you want to compare are actually what is called centrally symmetric, right? I mean, there is an origin, and, you know, if you do a minus, then it's somehow symmetric with respect to the origin. In the case of probabilities, that's no longer the case. And then this becomes actually kind of a little bit trickier how to compare them. I mean, there's no canonical center of gravity, right? I mean, so that was a fun discussion I had with Carlos a couple of weeks in the spring, so we enjoyed that a lot. But anyway, so in this symmetric case, it is easier. And here they are, the min and min, epsilon 1. But we can keep that for the rest, it's probably helpful. And now it's time for commercial break, right? So the question is, first of all, why epsilon and min, right? So that, of course, comes not from our, we stole that from Grothendieck. So, okay. Grothendieck, before he did algebraic geometry, he actually had a really important period for Banach spaces. It completely lay down for 10 years, and 10 years later, he discovered they can do a lot of things. And in fact, we are still catching up. So you give yourself, Grothendieck worked on Banach spaces, two Banach spaces. Banach space is just a vector space with a norm, right? So, and then you take the tensor product. We have seen that tensor products are actually important if you want to understand channels. So that's a good thing. And for two Banach spaces, you define a biggest norm, which makes this tensor product, again, a Banach space, okay? Or at least a norm space. And I call it pi norm, biggest norm. And anyway, here in this institute, that's probably a good idea. And so we take the infimum. This is a tensor product. So you take x from one from the other, and then you take the infimum of all decompositions of your tensor, and you do the thing which you do. You take the sum over the product of the norms. I mean, this is really the most natural thing you can actually come about, right? So this is the pi norm. Then that's the, if whenever you take another reasonable norm, this will be larger than the norm you have. And then there's the smallest norm where you say, okay, now I want to make something small, and the epsilon say, okay, if these are Banach spaces and they have a linear map, a scalar map from 1x to c, and the scalar map from 1y, so these are, you know, if you think of channels, these are very brutal channels, right? They erase every information and just send you to a scalar. These guys should still be bounded somehow. So what you do is you give yourself such a tensor, and you evaluate them at x star, at y star. This is a scalar. And then you take the supremum of all norm one elements. Right? And this expression actually, with a little bit of, you know, a little bit of translation is exactly what appeared in the formulation of local probabilities. Exactly this, supremum. Actually, not that. You have to think about it dually. In fact, it's really the pi norm expression. Right? You take all convex combinations of objects you like, and the objects you like are those which are the unit ball of your given space. Right? So this product, I want to show that. I mean, yeah, go ahead. I have to click anyway.
Of x tensor y, but I assume you mean when you're...
So the x case and y case in both formulas were not the same. I couldn't come back to this, but...
Okay.
Yeah? So what is
I know they're not the same.
Yeah. So what is important for the pi norm is this in point-wise product, okay? This point-wise product exactly translates in a one-to-one translation to... this expression.
Okay. Okay.
Those are
the norms of xk, the sub mean.
Right.
The norm
you should think of these xk's all having norm one, and then you take convex combinations. So you have good guys here, good guys there, and then you take the product of them and consider all convex combinations.
This is so just to make sure that the triangle inequality is.
Exactly. Yeah, you have to do it. Yeah, if not, you don't have a triangle. Exactly. And this is kind of the dual picture, right?
But I mean, so my question is, I know that it's not going to be the same decomposition, but on the left you really have a norm of Z, and you're taking the soup over all the ways that you can write it, but you're using the dual norms.
Right. Absolutely true, and that's exactly a crucial point, because, you know, if you have such a tensor, often you write it down, summation xk and yk. And this infimum is critical, because for the best infimum might be a completely weird decomposition, which you didn't have in mind. That's, you know, that will be true 89% of the time, right? So and here, for this one, I can start with any concrete, because I'm taking a supremum. That makes it easier to write it down, but anyway. So... but in order to come back,
why is that? That you can any concrete give you the same answer?
Because if you do linear algebra, if you have another representation here on this right hand side, you just do linear algebra. It doesn't change. So here you can do the supremum or concrete representation, but in the first one you have to look for all. But there's something. I mean, I think I want to point this out. So if you take such a supremum in the expression there, you can always take extreme points. And we talked about the unit cube today already, right? So the unit cube, the extreme points are these sequences which only have plus minus ones. And that is exactly what appeared before when we calculated the min norm. Because here, I could choose here for the coefficients one which only have plus minus ones, right? So this is exactly the connection. There's really a one-to-one connection by somehow calculating for a given matrix this expression which corresponds to local variables. That's the epsilon norm. Yeah? And then the same will be true in the quantum case. Yeah. So what I'm saying is if you calculate for a given matrix the supremum of all local correlations, so you're exactly calculating up to a little lie here. The norm in this epsilon tensor part. And of course, that gives us a lot of tools from Banach Bay theory. Interesting examples for norms which we should consider are P norms. I think you will not be surprised. P equals 1 and infinity are maybe
very important. For P equals 2, Cn is just the complex Hilbert space with the inner product. These norms are already. Now that's the non-commutative version of the p-norms, trace of the absolute value p. I will call them spn for shut-in p classes, but that's just for p equals 1, we called them trace classes before. For p equals n, these are just matrix algebras. And one norm which will be of interest for us will be L1 of L infinity norm, just saying, you know, L1 of L infinity, right? Some outside, sub inside. It's really suggestive. And here is something very interesting, which I think one should know. So you remember Grothendieck, fundamental, right? The biggest norm on two spaces. Let's do an example. Take the Schatten class, the trace class operators, space of all densities. Yeah, apply his construction, pi norm, right? All convex combinations of densities individually. So this pi norm exactly gives the set of all separable states if you restrict it to the positive part. So this, you know, this is why this. And we know that, of course, they are non-separable states, right? I mean, so there is, you know, there is a translation. And actually, this remark here for us is sort of important because we have this other theory, which is called operator spaces. Now, I don't want to do an introduction about operator spaces. It's about spaces and matrices. So in principle, something you like, right? And what is important is there are two things. Okay, so operator space, so maybe I say a little bit. So operator spaces is a subspace of matrices, or maybe infinite matrices, to tell you the truth. But and then we wanted to do something very similar, and I didn't. We wanted to find the smallest reasonable tensor norm. My goodness, what is he doing? Well, but look, I mean, we have, think of the subsystem of a code, right? I mean, the subsystem, which by a code we want to leave invariant. So we consider a subsystem of some bounded operators on a Hilbert space. This before was L of A, right? So we have one subsystem here, another subsystem here. We take the tensor product and just consider it as a subsystem of the new matrix algebra. And the induced norm we call the min norm. So I think if you for a moment don't think about densities, but about observables, then this is a very natural definition. And this is the smallest reasonable norm for us, just, you know, for the operator-based community, okay? If you take it like this, it's not completely false. So so the point, and this is exactly the meaning of this min. I can make that precise in all the cases we want to consider. This takes a little while, but I just want to tell you this is the right analog. So we're comparing, we somehow following Grothendieck steps, right? I mean, he has the min smallest norm, we have our smallest norm, and it turns out that comparing the two is exactly somehow understanding violation. And this is why our tools work so nicely. I mean, we have a dictionary, you apply it, and violation is saying min norm much larger than epsilon norm. Yeah, so that's, but there's something nice which I want to mention. So if you take matrix algebras by this definition and you take this min norm, you get the matrix algebras of the Hilbert space of the product of the dimension. That's right. And actually only for, you know, for super experts, we also have an analog of this pi norm, right? I mean the largest one. And if you take the tensor product for trace class operators, you don't get the separable space. You get exactly the right space. So that, you know, so there is an analog which gives the right states. And somehow that is sometimes helpful because we are not running in this problem. But the comparison between the two is exactly somehow comparing the Grothendieck-Banach space objects versus the operator space objects. But okay, that I promised the commercial part. But I think I said that already. So if we want to find violation for a two-partite system for correlations, we have to compare the epsilon norm and the min norm. And if you want to do this for three systems, oh, I think, sorry guys, I forgot another L1, right? So now the dictionary is clear. We just, you know, iterate these L1s. And if you want to do two systems, we have two L1s. If you want to do three systems, you have to do one, two, missing three, one, two, three. And you can go on. And actually, I should say that Grothendieck's inequality says that here you have only limited amount of violation, can only be by a constant. And what happens here, you know, some of you know, but for more than three, we have actually no idea whatsoever. Okay, and I said already. Yes, and the good thing is, yes.
You said that enforcing the no signaling constraint is kind of a pain for your norms, and that pain seems to have evaporated.
Yes, it's a little bit lying.
Okay.
but in fact, what I mean, what happens is we take this non-signally space, so the real space. I mean, we actually have to understand it as an operator system, and it turns out that the space we are interested in is somehow a copy with a little bit fewer inputs that's in there. And if we add a little bit junk, then it's almost, you know, up to a constant 2 or 4, it is the same. Now, if you are in experiments, a constant 2 or 4 is a nightmare. But if you, since here we are interested in large variations, n is huge, like in many talks here, right? So then a constant 2 or 4 is ridiculous, and with this little argument, we can wash it away. But it took us a long time to understand why it's true. So... But anyway, here's an important other point. So before we had this two-partite L1 system, and there is somehow Grothendieck's inequality with an obstruction of finding large violation. It just tells you the violation will not be bigger than the square of L1.7 something. But if you add these extra inputs and outputs, then there's also an epsilon and a min norm that is following the same kind of construction. And now you have a chance to find things where this here is much, much bigger than the other side. Yeah? So let me come to the results. The first result was with all the people I mentioned at the beginning. So for three-partite correlations, we have violation of order square root of n provided, well, yeah, I mean, so if you take the soup, it goes to infinity, but the n is optimal in two regards. It's either a rank n tensor, or you're testing it with n Hilbert space dimensions corresponding to Andreas K norms, right? I mean, this K is n. So we are testing this with an n-dimensional Hilbert space, and then violation of order square root of n is optimal. And then, of course, if n tends to infinity, you have unbounded violation.
Then we consider these probabilities together with the same set of authors. And here now we have a weaker result, square root of n over log n. But of course, here we only have a two-partite system. So if we can play three-partite, we are really strong. But with two-partite, you have to be clever. So here we found this relation, and here the restriction is that we only use this is input, this is output. We only use, I mean, we have an estimate depending on the number of outputs, which is of order square root of n. And very recently with Carlos, we were able to get the same estimate. I mean, for this particular matrix, we know it's of order square root of n. We know it's order bigger than square root of n over log n. But the important part here is that we can restrict n inputs and n outputs. And I think nothing like that had been known before. Usually, if you want to do such constructions, you have to allow yourself to do huge inputs. And this, in, I mean, there have been lower bounds of this sort for, yeah, you see that, n to the 10 to the minus 5. It's polynomial. Square root of n is also polynomial. I agree. But I think it's still a little bit better. But the fact that we can really just reduce it to so few inputs is kind of a little bit surprising. But in fact, What?
Only better than what is written.
Yes, that's true. okay, and now I want to come to the techniques, and I want to start with the hardest results. So
the random techniques, we use Kinchin inequality, we use, this is actually important, that if you calculate matrix units, there is something which is too small to be true, but it's true. And I will not very do this in a very detailed way. This kind of, you know, flashy thing here, right? So we actually do this with random unitaries. Not a big surprise. Everybody will have expected this. I wouldn't probably speak here. But we use random unitaries in a rather brutal way. So not only do we use concentration of matter mesh phenomena, we all would expect that, but we use something about tensor products of commuting unitaries. And we have to go to the, you know, large limit model, which is, if you don't mind, that's the tensor product of the reduced least algebra, right? I mean, so we use a limit model for the tensor product, and we pull something back, you know, we're using, say, so this has to be almost true, almost everywhere true on the matrix level, but we do a correction for this estimate here, so the tensor product of arbitrary unitaries, which is better than what you can do with concentration. I think there is no, I mean, we perturb our random unitaries in a way which we can only do using this infinite dimensional trick, and I have no idea how to do this in a concrete way, and I don't expect it to be true for the unitaries themselves. In fact, I know it's not true. So there are some things, if you start talking about commuting unitaries, you can perturb them in a very bizarre way, which is only witnessed in the, you know, in the infinite dimensional model. You can look it up. It's very easy. The proof is 3 lines. But if you pull it back, it becomes something really surprising. So there might be some, if ever you have to talk about commuting random, I mean, tensor product commuting unitaries, there's something to, you know, which is beyond what is the standard technology. It's not difficult if you know the technology, but this makes this estimate particularly inaccessible for any kind of concrete estimate. We have no idea, no control of dimension. So there's something huge there. That's exactly what I wanted to try to say. Now, for the second kind, our first estimate of violation for probabilities. How much time do I have? Oh, that's perfect. So there we use Banach-based technology. You know, I mean, that's where I come from, so I like that. So we know from Banach space theory, if you take the space LPN, it sits in L1M of L infinity M. You know, that's a random construction. M there is rather large, and that was our instruction. That's why we couldn't actually do something. But the subspace LPN of L1M, so you know, this is something which we had to consider. This is an object by our dictionary which occurs, so we could use that. And then we take the small subspace and the large subspace. And in this small subspace, we apply Dvoretsky. So you will hear a lot about Dvoretsky. Dvoretsky says, you give me a Banach space, and I tell you what is a nicer version part of it. You know, you take a ball, and you slice it out, and that looks almost like a Hilbert space. And, of course, these are classical Banach spaces. You know exactly where to find these Hilbert spaces. You take random matrices, you do it, and it's all known. Everything you know is known. So they're very easy to find. And that's what we did. We find a the subspace HN and LPN. Now there is a dimension, right? And this is not n-dimensional. But anyway, you get away with it, you do the estimate. The hard part is to show that if you do this Banach-based construction, that if you start calculating the minimal norm, this, you have to find your quantum objects which show that this is not classical. That is harder. And that took us a little while. In particular, any kind of, the calculating matrix norms whenever you have such a mixture, L1 is good, L infinity is good. If it's somewhere, but if you mix the nature, it's like, then it gets very difficult. But anyway, so, but there is an important information which we learned from there, namely that the maps which we want to consider to produce violation, they are somehow related. They come from they're T-star T-maps, right? I mean, they are really like operators on a Hilbert space. And then you use a positive map for an appropriate inner product, right? I mean, which is not appropriate for the norm, but as vector spaces, they have this nice form T-star T, which is nice, and that allows us to play. And so now I'm coming to some of the easiest case, where this is the sketch. So I'm taking now, I don't want to go into this. Let me go to step two here. So we take an n-dimensional subspace of L1 on of L infinity n. It's n-dimensional. It's taken at random. It does the job. Okay, so, and then we use some techniques. But I want to come to the specific form. So now we actually have these Bell inequalities become extremely concrete. You take plus minus one variables. I think here might be an n missing, 1 over k times n. So we take plus minus 1 variables for x and a, n of them, all of them independent, and sum them up and take these averages. These are the Bell inequalities will give you violation. The epsilon norm is less than log n, so that's good. The operators which you have to use in constructing the Bell violation are very concrete. Here they are, right? There is some kind of clever combination of rank one matrices projections, right? Build from the epsilons. And then at the last part, we have to do something in order to make it one. And then we take a state, and I can tell you can just take an arbitrary state. I mean, this is a bipartite state, right? So this is why you have this II here. And every state, the alpha I's, corresponds to the singular or eigenvalues. And then if we really like this kind of indicator of violation. You take the infinity norm times the one norm. The two norm, this summation squared, so we take the strange product. Yeah? And what I'm saying is if this object here is not one but bigger than two, then for any state we can produce violations which are bigger than this number. Yeah? But we have to pay this log n price. But so this means that if you give yourself a state, right? The state is governed by these eigenvalues, these alpha I. So if it's of this form, then it's no good. Okay, it's rank one, but that's clear because then this is a separable object. If it's constantly 1 over square root of n, it's no good. But any other guy will give you a violation. Any other state. So somehow, if you're not too picky or you're not too flat, you will find violation. If you can find, you can choose matrices. And so let me just say that. So there's this notion of entropy, right? If you have such a state, you can measure the entropy of entanglement. And what we can show is we can find states which have entanglement of the order delta over log n, or entanglement of the order log n minus delta. So, almost maximally entangled. Almost not entangled at all in terms of entropy, violation is the same. We get violation. If you want violation, the violation, so the ratio m applied to, let me write this down. I can write this down. X, y, h of c, t, x, a, tensor, s, b, s, y, b, c. This here is bigger than the constant over square root of n log n squared times the epsilon 1. So some of the violation is of order square root of n over log n squared for both of these states. Yeah, so we have actually a family. So this is kind of surprising because before we thought you need a lot of entanglement to have good violation. Now, it has almost nothing to do with it. At least if you take these random examples, which are coming from plus minus one matrices, it doesn't really matter. I mean, it cannot be totally, I mean, of course, if it has no entanglement whatsoever, then this is impossible, right? But, I mean, it sort of is almost independent of the thing, and I think I should stop here.
Yes. Do you know for a fact that this sample can be actually measured in an experiment?
These guys?
Yeah.
Well, they haven't been tried yet.
No, but in principle, it's possible to have an experiment, right? Something reasonably realistic experiment, right? So, did the physicists tell you that? Well, we can maybe measure this.
This violation? Violation is measured in an experiment.
I mean your specific violations, which are huge.
Yeah, I'm trying to convince my colleague to do this, but, you know, I don't know how large n has to be, and that's always a problem.
So yeah. Are you saying that for the tripartite case, you can't even tell the experimenter what kind of system he has to take?
No, I cannot even tell, because this unconstructed part, unfortunately, is in the It's in the construction of the state. In order to find the state where the high violation comes in, I have this unconstructed aspect. I mean, the rest are unitaries. Most of the operators are random unitaries in some sense. I mean, random unitaries, not, I mean, really, build them out of. But in order to see which state is optimal, at the moment, this is using this construction, using the Wassermann construction for free products.
But do you know what dimension at least it would be? Because then you could just, you know, find the large diagonal.
We cannot even prove that if you have, say, you fix this one filter space n-dimensional, we do not even know that there is any existent bound. We cannot provide any existence. I mean, at the moment, it's really, you know, mathematically, we're using an ultrafilter, right? Take the least power limit and I mean, ultrafilters are not so bad. We have talked about convergence of measures. That's the same story. But still, I mean, it would be really super nice if anybody could come up with a more precise estimate where you, I mean, I don't even care about the square root of n. It could be n to the power 1 over 55. But any kind of more concrete way would be very nice, but at the moment we have no clue. Yeah, so it's the state of the art.
Different question. In this last part, obviously it's not going to work if psi is very close to product, but do you know that you can't get this sort of behavior if psi is very close to Maxwell entangled?
Well, actually, that's if you allow us to use 2 to the n many inputs, or maybe 2 to the n squared, I would have to look it up. We can show that the maximal entangled state, I mean, with a slightly modified construction, we can show that for the maximal entangled state, the violations may be bounded by 10 or 15. So bounded violation, their example is bounded violation for the maximal entangled states, but the of course, the square root of n is still here, but just not for a maximally entangled state.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is, you can't find it for maximally entangled states.
No, we know there is none.
Oh, you know
it's
there
bounded.
Is
bounded. I mean,
oh, you know
if it's bounded. If we choose 2 to the n squared many inputs, there's only bounded violation for the maximal entangled state, but there is tons of violation. Exactly, you know, this estimates with the eyeball quantity, which someone tells you you're not too far rank 1 or you're not too far from maximally entangled. That's perfectly valid. All these states give violation, but the maximal entangled just sucks in that point. Right? Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? And let's thank you very much again.